My name is Matthew Novenson. I'm professor of biblical criticism and biblical antiquities at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland.
Dr. Matthew Novenson. Matt, good to see you. Welcome to the Stone Chapel podcast.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
First of all, congratulations on your recent promotion.
Thanks very much.
That's exciting for a guy from Tennessee.
This is
a world-class, wonderful university.
Yeah.
And students are clamoring to get here. You got great, great people following what you're doing all around. But for those who don't know who Matthew Novenson is, who is he?
Well, I teach biblical studies at the University of Edinburgh, but as you said, I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and by way of St. Louis, Missouri, Princeton, New Jersey, Raleigh, North Carolina, I ended up in Edinburgh back in 2011. I moved here. Mm-hmm. So my family and I live in Edinburgh, though we've got kids who are now entering university age who might be leaving Edinburgh and going elsewhere.
But, oh, really? Okay. So. You can't persuade them to stick around, huh?
We'll see.
I hope you can. You've written a terrific book that was published back in 2012, published by Oxford University Press, entitled Christ Among the Messiahs, Christ Language in Paul, and Messiah Language in Ancient Judaism. It's done very well. Congratulations, first of all, on that book. I know it's been a while, but I find it very valuable for scholars sometimes to take a look back over the last decade and say, learn from that book and what's developed from then. Right when a book is published, there's a lot of kind of excitement about it and a lot of movement about it and a lot of reviews that come out. But then after about a decade, it's time to maybe reassess. So we're here to talk a little bit about your book today. For people who don't know this particular book, and it's a terrific book, you can find it, by the way, at your friendly Lanier Theological Library, probably multiple copies of it. What's the big idea of your book? I tell students that every good book, every important book has a big idea. What's the big idea?
Yeah, the big idea of that book is that the word Christ, or Greek Christos, in the letters of Paul, means Messiah. All of that needs a little explaining, but it's that simple. It's about one word in one small corpus, namely the letters of Paul, arguing that we should understand it broadly as meaning this particular thing.
So for some scholars, they've made the case that Christ is sort of just another name for Jesus, that when Paul uses it, that he uses it as a name, just like he calls him sometimes Jesus. He other times calls him Christ, and it doesn't mean any more than that. Why did they conclude that, you think?
That's the big question, and that was kind of the background to my writing of this book. Nowadays, and there were rumblings of it when I was writing this book, you will hear or read relatively often from scholars working in biblical or ancient Jewish or early Christian studies that the word Christos means Messiah, even in Paul's letters or other early Christian texts. But when I was working on this, and I was working on the manuscript, first of all, as a PhD student back in the aughts. If you read commentaries or theologies of Paul from, up to the millennium or so, from the 1990s or earlier, you will usually read in a section on Christology in Paul something like, by the time Paul uses the word Christos, it functions like a proper name, just like Jesus. And it's not a title, like Lord is a title or King is a title. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of saying, there's nothing to see here.
Mm-hmm. Move along.
So the question you ask rightly is, why did people think that? But the good reason they had for thinking it was there are certain patterns in the way Paul writes the word Christos that are different from the way it's written, like in the Gospels and Acts. And so some of these scholars were observing the difference and saying, Paul writes it differently because it's a name. But the other really important reason behind that tradition of scholarship was there's a grand story about the place of Paul in early Christianity that was told throughout the 19th and 20th centuries in scholarship that said that Paul successfully sort of Hellenized Christianity, right? Took what was originally a Jewish sect, Hellenized, that is, turned Greek, parts of it that it could sort of be successful as a world religion could spread among Gentiles, people who, you know, worshipped other gods and didn't know the God of Abraham and so on. For that to happen, so this argument went, someone had to Hellenize the religion. And Paul was given credit for doing that because he does, of course, call himself and, you know, seems to have acted in his role as apostle to the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. So there was a whole package of scholarly ideas that said in order for him to be apostle to the Gentiles, he had to deconstruct and reconstruct the message about Jesus, had to make it no longer a culturally Jewish thing, but make it something different. And one key plank in that whole idea was that he had to make Jesus no longer a Messiah, which is a Jewish category, but something else, a Lord or something like that.
He had to leave that behind, the Jewishness behind.
That's right. So there's usually some kind of theory along those lines about Paul, leaving behind aspects of Judaism in his preaching of Christ that go with these summary statements in scholarship that say Christ is just a proper name for Paul, not a meaningful title or something like that.
I remember reading that back in the 70s and I thought, gosh, that doesn't seem right. Mm-hmm. You know, it just didn't strike me. And of course, I've not done the extensive work that you've done in it, but it never struck me as right. And it seemed to me to be an avoiding of something. Of course, I always thought the Jewishness of Jesus was more important, even in Paul, than subsequent scholars as well. So let's talk about the language, the word Christos, because that comes across in our Bible translations as Christ. So we've just simply transliterated it, right?
Basically, yes, but there's an interesting twist. So yes, we say Christ in English for what in the Greek Bible is Christos. So that's a transliteration, not a translation, right? It's just taking, as you said, it's taking the word from the one language and just putting it into the letters of our language, basically. Except that, this is the interesting twist. So the word Christos etymologically means anointed one, or in a Hebrew context, you'd say Messiah. So in English Bibles, and of course it varies translation to translation, but in a lot of the English Bibles that you and I and your listeners would know, that would be in a library or in a church pew or something, when the word Christos appears in Greek in the Gospels, then an English Bible will translate it as Messiah. But when the same word Christos appears in the Greek Bible in Paul's letters, they transliterate it Christ. So the translators make a decision to do two different things in the two different
texts, why you need to learn to read Greek.
That's right, right? That's right.
It's because, one of the many reasons.
Well, exactly. If you only had an English Bible, you wouldn't know that it's the same word and that a translator has decided that it's doing two different things. And the reason they make that translation decision is because they're believing this story in the Pauline theologies that say it's just a proper name, and so you can just transliterate it Christ.
Right.
But they have made that decision for you, right? And right, so that's why it's useful to go back and say...
I've known some scholars of late who, in doing their own Bible translations, will say something like, Iesus Christos means Jesus the Messiah.
Yeah.
So they try to reinvest it with Messianic languages too.
Yeah. There's, again, there's more of that now, certainly, than there was in the...
So you've had some influence, I think, in that.
I have influenced some of it. Other people have come to it independently. I mean, it's related to a whole reconsideration in the last 10 to 20 years in New Testament studies about, I mean, anti-Judaism in the history of New Testament scholarship, which, I mean, a serious soul-searching began after the Holocaust in the mid-20th century in biblical scholarship, as in theology and other fields. But, I mean, in my academic lifetime, so to speak, sort of the last 10 to 20 years when I've been a graduate student and then a working scholar, this has been a main concern in a lot of professional biblical studies circles, is sort of reassessing a lot of habits we have that have to do with the kind of troubled relation between Christians and Jews and Christianity and Judaism. And so I think that's why it's, you know, in the Pauline letters in scholarship, my book is part of that story and has maybe influenced a few other people, but others have been coming at it from different angles too.
A lot of that biblical criticism, biblical theology, scholarship, it came out of Germany. It came out of Europe and other places as well. A lot of, even some East Coast in North America kinds of kinds of schools where there was still a, kind of an anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism. So part of your book deals with Messiah language in ancient Judaism. There are some who make the claim that, well, Messiah was not really a broad category. There's not much Messiah talk in ancient Judaism. Did you come to that, or did you come to a different perspective?
I use the phrase in the book and in the subtitle of the book, and as you have just been saying, Messiah language, which is might strike some people's ears kind of funny. It's not the usual way it's talked about, because we usually talk about, and even scholarship conventionally talked about, messianic hopes or messianic expectations or something. And so messiahs or messianism were usually discussed in terms of expectations, psychological states, you might say, right? So what I was interested, though, it's for a historian, it's more challenging to make claims about ancient psychological states.
Sure, yeah.
Than it is
to make...
You can't
psychoanalyze somebody point, right?
But we can. We have much more direct access to texts, right, and to language. And so I was interested in this question about, well, where does the word Messiah actually appear in ancient sources from around the period that we're talking about here? So the Hellenistic and the early Roman period, the time of... You know, you could say the first century CE is kind of at the middle of this. I was looking out a couple of centuries in either direction. And the answer is, it's not everywhere in Jewish sources, but it's relatively frequent in certain ones. It appears not at all in any non-Jewish or Christian source until Roman writers start to talk about the Christians. So that's one point, is that the word Christ or Messiah or anointed is a specifically Jewish idiom. If it weren't for the Hebrew Bible and the language of God's anointed one, the word wouldn't exist in the discourse in the ancient world. So the reason it exists is because of this idiom from the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, after which it appears in a number of Jewish sources, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, and it occurs exactly contemporary with the Dead Sea Scrolls and this, you know, in this period, the beginning of the Roman Empire. In the letters of Paul, and then after Paul in the Gospels and Acts, and
because in terms of historical development, Paul's writings come before the writing of the Gospels.
Yeah, Paul's letters are the earliest written of the texts that are in the New Testament.
Right.
So a famous kind of puzzle that you will know well. Anyone who's taught the New Testament, right, to students has to think about this. It makes sense to teach Jesus first, because Jesus.
Right.
The events of Jesus' life are earlier than the events of Paul's apostleship. But the texts are the other way around. So Paul's letters are written earlier than the Gospels are written. Not much earlier, but a bit.
Right. But they come from the same sort of worldview, world perspective.
Yeah. And all so they all use the word Christos, Messiah, and they all use it only of Jesus, basically. But if you don't artificially separate, this was one argument in my book, that we shouldn't artificially separate... You know, Jewish texts over here mean one thing by the word Christos or Mashiach, Messiah, while Christian texts mean an entirely different thing by the word. I think that assumption, while it's often made, is not true. So if you think about Paul writing in the middle of the first century CE, he didn't know that his letters would be part of the Christian Bible and would be the material out of which whole Christian systematic theologies would be made. He didn't know all that. He was a Jewish apostle or messenger talking about a figure who he called Messiah or anointed, which is a biblical word straight out of the Greek Old Testament, right? Or the Greek Jewish Bible. And so historically, it makes perfect sense to read him alongside other people from his time and his same religious identity. So kind of like the Dead Sea Scrolls, those authors are not writing in Greek, but they're using the Hebrew or Aramaic equivalencies for the words. And to see how his letters make sense alongside other Jewish writers from exactly the same time using the same words. So that's what I was after with the Messiah language as a...
Messiah language. And there are other kinds of words and phrases that come along too, other than the word Messiah, but we'll have to leave that for another time. For close, one of the things that you helped me understand, I think, and a lot of people, is you use the language of honorific to refer to a word like Christos. Now, we're not totally knowledgeable about what that word means. Tell us a little bit. Educate us a little bit. What does that honorific mean exactly?
So honorific, so we're using it there as a noun. Like for Paul writes the word Christos or Christ as an honorific. Mm-hmm. So that's a term that I took from, there's a whole sub-discussion in classics in the study of ancient Greek and Roman worlds about names, onomastics, so naming, the actual way you give people names mm-hmm. in ancient Greek and Latin literature and documentary sources. And the interesting thing is, so in English we have this debate, like if you read the old commentaries on Paul, they'll say, Christ, is it a name or a title? Mm-hmm. As if there are two options, uh-huh. name and title, and it has to be one or the other.
One or the other, right.
So, but there was a lot of research coming out when I was working on this book manuscript back in the day from people studying inscriptions and papyri and ancient documentary sources and just looking at people's names, right? And what forms they took. Kind of like now, right? I have three names. A lot of people nowadays in, you know, American born, like I have three names, but not everybody. Right. Some people have two names and not a middle name.
Yeah.
In the UK, it's very common here for people to have four names, mm-hmm. right? Two middle ones, so to speak. And again, as soon as you move to another country or another language context,
you might realize, have five names.
Exactly. Yeah. So the naming.
I know some people from Venezuela that have five names.
That's right. So, and this is the point, right? We don't know. I mean, you tend to assume if you don't stop and think about it, or you don't flag it up for attention, you assume that other people in other cultures and times did what we do, unless you stop and think about it. And this is the point. It turns out ancient Greeks and Romans had much more than two names, usually, right? There are lots of sort of relevant categories. And honorific was one of these. Most just normal people on the street didn't have an honorific, but mm-hmm. public figures often did. Mm-hmm. The most famous example is the word Augustus. It's the mm-hmm. most famous honorific probably in the ancient world. The person we call Augustus, who was the first Roman emperor, his name was Octavian. Mm-hmm. His title was emperor. Mm-hmm. But he went by Augustus, right? And this, I argue in the book, is the way it's written is the same kind of way Paul writes the word Christos or Christ in combination with Jesus, Jesus, his name, and Kurios or Lord, his title. Mm-hmm. He also has an honorific, and that's Christos or Christ. Mm-hmm. And what I did not know, kind of was surprised to find, was if you look at the sources writing honorifics like Augustus, his name is written. It could be written Caesar Augustus or Augustus Caesar in either direction. Mm-hmm. The same way Paul can write Jesus Christ or Christ Jesus or call him just Jesus or just Christ. The point is, this is kind of how honorifics are written. There's something different from either name or title, but they're often written in combination with names in either order or as stand-ins for names. And all of this is, without exception, is how Paul writes the word Christos or Christ. And so that's one of the big points in the argument of the book is it was always a mistake to insist that it had to be either a name or a
name
title.
Name or title. Yeah. So this third way, this third category of honorific might actually fit better Paul's own usage.
Yeah, that's right. That's anticipating what is the conclusion of the book.
Yeah. So. So since this book has come out, it's been reviewed favorably, I would imagine, but also unfavorably by some. Have you learned anything from those unfavorable reviews?
Yeah, I try always to learn from unfavorable reviews, so I like to think yes. I have done. Although, I have...
You changed your mind about anything?
Not on anything significant. I always learn from the unfavorable reviews, but I stand by the argument of that book entirely, more or less. So, you know, there are points where I'd say, oh, yeah... Maybe I got this or that detail a bit wrong, or I should have said this differently, but I still think that the argument there is pretty much right. But someone may come along and convince me otherwise.
Yeah, but so far they haven't. So far they haven't, yeah. And do you think now most scholars would agree who study these things that Christ in Paul is not really just a second name, but that really does have some messianic content to it?
I think way more scholars think that now than thought that, you know, 20 years ago. Some of those in the last 10 years were persuaded by me. Some of them, as I've said, have kind of thought their way to this issue through other avenues, which mm-hmm. is great. But there are still, I mean, I think, as you will understand, maybe some of your listeners will understand, you know, scholarship, like a lot of, you know, human endeavors, it's social and it's provincial. And so there's arguments that will, that become really persuasive, you know, in one country, but not in another, mm-hmm. or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. There's kind of different local... orthodoxy. Fair enough, yeah. So an argument that, you know, might work well in the U.S. might not work, might not be as well received in Germany, or, you know, in the U.K. in relation mm-hmm. to Israel or something like that. On some of these, biblical scholarship has... So anyway, that's to say, there's some corners of the world that are still not entirely convinced of my thesis. But I think if you look at the broad sweep of biblical scholarship, I think there's a lot more willingness now to, on this particular issue, to read messianic Christology, so to speak, in Paul, and indeed to reconsider the bigger questions about the relation Paul and the other apostles and other New Testament writers stand in relation to Judaism in first century.
Dr. Matthew Novenson, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Thanks very much.
If we have left you wanting more, we did that on purpose. Keep listening, and at the end of this podcast, our guest will share with you a nugget of wisdom. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation and found some word of encouragement, instruction, and correction, or anything that helps you renew your mind. The Stone Chapel podcast are brought to you by the Lanier Foundation and the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. Thanks to our production staff, headed by Kathy Capes. Always great to thank Phil Keggy for our music. Do you have questions, comments? We always love to hear from you. Email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Now, Lanier is spelled L-A-N-I-E-R. Until next time, I'm David Capes. Thanks for listening.
Because I'm talking with David Capes, when I think about nuggets of wisdom, I think about our common friend, Larry Hurtado of blessed memory. And Larry illustrated for me the value of kind of keeping the main thing, despite a really illustrious career. He focused on his friends and family and the people around him, and in academia focused on his first love, talking about the ideas and the texts and the things that were all, you know, the reason we got into this business in the first place. And I try to keep that goal always before my eyes.